It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning. In Washington, President Obama is holding a news conference later this morning as the debt and budget showdown continues between the White House and Congress. This comes after a campaign-style appearance in Iowa yesterday, where the president touted the benefits of making investments in the latest in manufacturing. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Every 4 years, Iowa produces a bumper crop of presidential candidates who stand on hay bales, pet prize-winning hogs, and nod with interest at the rising price of a bushel of corn. President Obama may do all of that before long, but his first visit to Iowa in this summer before the caucuses found Mr. Obama not in a field, but a factory. That's no accident. Mr. Obama sees factories, like the Alcoa aluminum rolling plant in Bettendorf, Iowa, as a key ingredient in America's economic revival.
A big part of our future has to be a robust and growing manufacturing sector. We've got to make things right here in America.
Manufacturing certainly led the way in Iowa. The state's factories added some 2,500 jobs last month alone, and that's helped keep the unemployment rate enviably low at just 6%. Dave Swenson of Iowa State University says manufacturing's role in the state's economy often goes unappreciated.
If you ask people, what's the biggest industry in Iowa, they're going to say agriculture. Many people won't even get to manufacturing by the fourth or fifth try.
But the total manufacturing payroll in Iowa is nearly three times that of farming, partly because factories offer some of the best paying jobs in the state.
They are the entree into a middle class lifestyle for a lot of Iowans that otherwise wouldn't have an opportunity for that kind of earnings.
President Obama sees similar potential for manufacturing nationwide. Walking through the Alcoa plant yesterday with the general manager and the president of the local steelworkers union, Mr. Obama was impressed by the 30-ton cranes overhead and the color-coded charts tracking quality and workflow.
That's what made you guys competitive, having the best workers, but also having the best equipment. You had to up your game. And that's what we've got to do as a country as a whole.
The White House said this visit was simply a chance for the president to make his case for advanced manufacturing. But one couldn't help noticing all the Republican presidential hopefuls who've also been spending time in Iowa.
I know you've been seeing a lot of politicians around lately. Something tells me that you may see a few more before February is over. Iowa... You and I, we go a long way back.
It was at a town hall meeting 3 years ago that Mr. Obama first met Cynthia Ross Friedhoff. The Bettendorf restaurant owner wowed the candidate with her description of her signature dish, the Magic Mountain. Loose meat, French fries, and cheddar cheese sauce piled high on Texas toast. Yesterday, Mr. Obama surprised Friedhoff by stopping by Ross's 24-hour restaurant for a sample.
Now, I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to eat one of these, though. Oh, look at this. You guys ever had one of these?
Oh, yeah.
Wonderful.
Huh?
To Friedhoff's delight, the president ordered half a dozen mountains for himself and his staff, including two so-called volcanoes topped with chili and onions.
I hope he brought his antacids because he said he's going to need one after he eats a Magic Mountain, he thinks, but I don't think so.
Friedhoff's father started the restaurant in the 1940s, and it's the kind of local landmark visiting politicians often use for a friendly photo op. One regular customer recalled Rudy Giuliani dropping in and said it's not unusual to go for lunch and wind up shaking hands with a presidential candidate. To see the president himself, she said, that is unusual. But maybe not so much in the hotly contested contest about to begin. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
The housing market is still in a slump, but with prices so low in many parts of the country, investors are snapping up properties with cash. Roughly one-third of homes purchased in the United States this year were bought that way. That is three times the normal rate, according to the National Association of Realtors. In Baltimore, more than half of homes sold this year have been bought with cash, as NPR's Alex Kellogg reports.
Janet Tompkins is making a name for herself around Baltimore. And she's not above bragging about it.
I am known as the Baltimore real estate diva. I buy properties just like a lot of women buy shoes.
But instead of shopping at high-end boutiques, Tompkins shops in transitioning Baltimore neighborhoods. Most of her tenants are low-income renters who qualify for federally subsidized housing. That's guaranteed money. But she still goes the extra mile, putting granite countertops and hardwood floors in her homes.
How are you today?
I'm fine.
All right, so we're going to go to 720 Newington.
On a recent afternoon, she picked up a prospective renter who didn't have a car, a 28-year-old single mother named Andrea Jeter. Tonkins used to invest elsewhere in the country, but for the past 2 years, she's bought only in Baltimore, the city she calls home. She's purchased more than 24 properties here, each dirt cheap and bought with nothing but cash.
Baltimore right now is an excellent time in Baltimore City to buy properties. Properties that were going 2 or 3 years ago for $300,000 and $400,000, you can now pick them up for $20,000 to $30,000.
Baltimore's median home sales price slipped to just $95,000 this spring. That's helped cash home sales reach their highest rate on record. 62% of home sales were cash sales in May, according to MRIS, the Regional Real Estate Listing Service. One reason? Banks and credit unions remain reluctant to make loans. There's also a glut of distressed properties on the market in Baltimore, meaning homes that are vacant, in foreclosure, or the like. In fact, more than half of all homes sold so far this year in Baltimore were distressed.
I mean, all those things are bad, but at the same time, it's good. I look at it as a good opportunity for me.
That's Juan Zayas. Like Tonkins, he has been gobbling up rundown properties in recent years.
The more damages, the more messed up or the more distressed the property look, the more I can see like a diamond in the rough.
On a recent afternoon, he gave me a tour of several homes he owns, including a duplex he bought in Northeast Baltimore in May. He paid just $45,000 for the home. A worker spackling drywall on the second floor is making just one of many improvements. Zayas plans to put about $75,000 worth of work into the property.
All I got to do is just polish it, make it really nice, you know, to get a true gem. So when I looked at this property, that's what it was.
When that's done, he says its market value, even today, is more than $200,000. But investors like Zayas and Tonkins rarely resell homes quickly. More often than not, they rent them out. That's because while home prices are dropping nationwide, rents are rising. So Zayas fixes up the properties he buys, hoping that in several years, home prices will rise again. City officials in Baltimore are welcoming this new crop of investors.
Some people say, well, these guys are bottom feeders, they're slumlords. Actually, they are the antidote to the slumlords because they are providing a product of quality for these renters.
That's Paul Graziano, Baltimore's housing commissioner.
Not only are they creating more homeownership opportunities, but also a much better quality of rental housing, affordable rental housing through Section 8.
A glut of vacant bank-owned properties, many of them in disrepair, may not sound like a recipe for a housing turnaround. But city officials say this is Baltimore's best bet right now. Alex Kellogg, NPR News.
California Governor Jerry Brown has mended fences with his fellow Democrats and is now poised to sign a new state budget by the end of this week. This comes after he vetoed a budget 2 weeks ago that he said was full of accounting tricks. As John Myers of member station KQED reports, finally getting a budget at all has brought no jubilation, but at least some relief.
California faced a $26 billion budget hole when Jerry Brown took office in January. The hole was created by a long-term imbalance of taxes and spending and exacerbated by a floundering economy. But in the fiscal year that begins Friday, Brown and his fellow Democrats in the state's legislature are banking on hope that a recent uptick in tax revenues will bring in an unexpected $7.5 billion.
We do expect more revenues in the budget year coming up, but in case we're over-optimistic, we have severe trigger cuts that will be triggered and go into effect.
That proposal, optimistic revenue projections but a backup plan of cuts, is why Governor Brown says he will sign the budget approved by the state legislature Tuesday night. Almost 2 weeks ago, he vetoed a budget that instead closed the final gap with gimmicks. One gimmick, for example, raided a protective fund of tobacco tax dollars, even though it's already been blocked by the courts. Still, California's biggest budget solution is less spending, to the tune of $15 billion.
This budget is the most austere fiscal blueprint California has seen in more than a generation.
Democrat Daryl Steinberg is the leader of the California State Senate.
Spending levels are at historic lows, and every sector of society will feel the difficult choices we've made to bring the budget into balance.
Colleges and universities will almost surely raise tuition in response to deep cuts, and some of the biggest cuts overall are being made in health and welfare programs. K through 12 schools, the largest part of California's budget, will have billions of dollars of their funding delayed. Nowhere in the new budget is a tax increase. Governor Brown tried all year to cajole out of Republicans an extension of temporary taxes, $11 billion worth, that would be sent to a statewide ballot for voters to ratify. Over the weekend, he gave up. Republicans like State Senator Bob Huff says the budget now in place proves those taxes were never really needed.
If we now have the revenue that we needed at the beginning of the year, why is it we keep going back to the voters and asking for yet more?
Governor Brown insists those additional taxes are still needed to help pay off accumulated state debt and pay for a realignment of state and local government. To do that, Brown says he may go around lawmakers and take his plans directly to California voters through a ballot initiative in 2012. For NPR News, I'm John Myers in Sacramento.
Bank of America said today that it will pay $8.5 billion to settle a lawsuit stemming from the collapse of the mortgage market. Investors claim they were misled about the value of certain mortgage-backed securities sold by Countrywide Financial, which was later bought by Bank of America. And as NPR's Jim Zaroli reports, the company's legal troubles aren't over yet.
When Bank of America bought Countrywide in 2008, it thought it was getting a real deal, a chance to take over one of the giants of the mortgage business. But the purchase has caused the company no end of trouble, says bank analyst Nancy Bush.
Oh, boy. It was one of the great stinkers of banking history.
The mortgage business was crashing even as the purchase was taking place, and Countrywide turned out to be a cesspool of legal liabilities because of the mortgages it sold and underwrote. And as the company that purchased it, Bank of America had inherited responsibility for them. Last year, 22 institutional investors sued the company over some securities they'd purchased from Countrywide. Jacob Frankel is a securities lawyer.
These were bundled securities of high-risk mortgages that the various financial institutions had put together, repackaged, and sold as investment vehicles to sophisticated investors.
The investors alleged that Countrywide had misled them about the quality of the mortgages underlying the securities, and they said Countrywide hadn't kept accurate records of the loans it made. The investors who filed the suit included some of the biggest and most prominent names on Wall Street, including the bond firm PIMCO and the insurance giant MetLife.
What makes this litigation unique is that you have the major institutions suing other financial institutions.
Bank of America first vowed to vigorously defend itself against the suit, but Nancy Bush, contributing editor at SNL Financial, says the company ultimately decided it wasn't worth the fight.
This continues to be the major issue that was hanging over that company. So I think they felt that they may have to eat a little bit of crow because of this, but I think they felt it was worthwhile.
Bush says the decision to settle will be good for the mortgage industry as a whole and ultimately even for consumers. Ever since the financial crisis, U.S. banks have been operating under a lot of uncertainty over regulation and legal challenges. Slowly, she says, that's being eliminated, and the settlement announced today is another big step forward.
It gives us just a little piece of clarity, and when you have sort of taking the sword of Damocles away from the biggest player in the industry, then I think it does help somewhat.
That's not to say Bank of America's troubles are over. The settlement announced today will wipe out the profit the company has earned this year, and the company still faces legal challenges. Bank of America said it will have to set aside more money to settle other claims from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and from unspecified private investors. And the company is under investigation by state attorneys general over its foreclosure practices. Bank of America is trying to move beyond the financial crisis, but doing so is proving enormously costly. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.